Hey, welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have my hero, Dan Gurney. Daniel Sexton Gurney. We spent a lot more time than I expected, about 40 minutes on the phone, speaking about the great American's record at Le Mans, speaking about his 1967 win with Ford and his friend, dear friend, A.J. Foyt, spoke about his introduction to Le Mans, and frankly, I believe just about every single one of his 10 visits. Also shared a pretty interesting insight about what he learned about getting to the finish at Le Mans, which played such an important part of their win in 1967 with Ford. And also spoke on the psychological efforts that he made with A.J. Foyt in 1967. Not against A.J., but just to set the right tone and culture within that program that year with that car to get to the finish. Always a pleasure speaking with a big eagle. As I said, he is and has been my absolute hero for many, many years. Fortunate to call him a good friend as well. So hopefully you enjoyed listening to Dan. We don't get to hear as much from him as we would like these days, but thankfully Big Eagle made some time for us to celebrate Le Mans as Ford returns.
You doing okay?
Pretty good.
Brother, you've covered a lot of miles. Yeah, I mean, you do realize you've won the endurance race. You don't have to keep winning it over and over again.
I thought you did a good job on that, or a very good job on the Mark III GDP car.
Oh, thank you, sir. Just wanted to share a little bit of love for one of my favorite machines, so thank you for helping with that.
Yeah. Well, it was very good to see it and to read about it. So tell me, what do you want to... I can tell you all about these 24-hour things.
Well, I'm heading back to France. This will be my 10th trip covering Le Mans, and I, at least by my numbers, I seem to recall that you competed in 10 of them, so I just thought it might be fun to wind the clock back with no particular agenda and just start off by asking about how you got your first invitation to race at Le Mans and what you thought of that crazy track when you saw it for the first time.
1958.
Yeah.
And Luigi Canetti called and said, would you like to come and drive one of my cars at Le Mans? And of course, I said, no, I'd rather be on unemployment. As I look back, it was a culture shock. We stayed in a place next to a railroad station. I can't think of the name of it. Hotel International or something like that.
You must have gotten a lot of good sleep next to a train station.
Well, if you're tired enough, it doesn't make any difference. I do recall, I mean, in those days, the bathroom equipment reminded me of, it had two foot-shaped things that you step on and then it bombs away.
Wow.
And, yeah. But, and then all these Frenchmen with a bit of long piece of bread under their armpit and a guillotine cigarette hanging out of their lips on a bicycle with the light blue coveralls on.
Yeah, so, that would have been culture shock.
Yeah, it was, but it was fantastic. I loved every moment of it. Luigi was a great guy, and I was with Bruce Kessler.
Yeah.
And, we just had a great time. I remember when I happened to be there when they fired up our cars. It had come from Modena, from the factory, And
these are the Ferrari 250 TRs, I believe.
That's
the
correct.
Testarossas.
And they even had sort of little megaphones on the back. But they were smoking like nobody's business.
Wow.
And I thought, well, wow, that's not going to last very long. And but sure enough, in the race, the exhaust turned, the inside of the exhaust turned white, and it wasn't using any oil or anything. I guess that was just the way they shipped them. Well, everything I looked at or could see was new in terms of surroundings and buildings and bicycles and the city itself. And then, of course, the Le Mans track seemed plenty narrow.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what were your first impressions of the track at speed and something at, you know, at that time, a Ferrari 250 Testarossa must have been a spaceship compared to some of the little four-cylinder farty things on the track. What was that track like in that kind of a car?
First, I was awestruck because of the reputation of the whole race and the surroundings. But it was narrow and it was pretty smooth. There were places where we went around where at the end of the Mulsanne Strait, there was a pile of sand on the exit, and sure enough, they said, well, that's where a lot of guys get stuck, because I guess they were, they'd been going fast for 3 miles, and they didn't quite slow down enough, and they didn't make the exit very well, and ended up in the sand. It was a pile, you know, the pile was no more than 2 feet high, but it was enough to, it took the guy a while to get out if it
gets stuck in the kitty litter.
Stuck in it, yeah.
Wow. So, from those Ferraris, am I correct in the next thing you drove was Jaguar Briggs Cunningham?
Yeah, that's right.
So to go from a beautiful, I was just going to say, a beautiful Ferrari to a beautiful Jaguar E-Type. I mean, that's, you're already plucking at the heartstrings there.
Well, it was, again, that was, I felt the same way. It was a great privilege to drive the E-Type. I think it was the first time they had run an E-Type there. I was sharing it with...
It was Walt Hanskin, I believe?
Walter Hanskin, yes. Who was a really, really outstanding driver, and I had great respect for him. An East Coast guy, and I had initially a little bit of something wasn't quite right on the straightaway, because the car would a side wind would move it around quite a bit. And but Walter refused to complain. He was like Lasorda, no, his Jaguar blue. And I got a lot of criticism for complaining, and they finally fixed it. And then it was rock solid, and it went fast. It was a fast car.
Was it just a panel that was maybe loose somewhere that was catching air funny, or... Do you remember what it was that was making the car wander with when it got hit from the side?
I think it had toe out on the rear wheels.
Because that's what you'd want in high-speed corners, naturally.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they fixed it, and that was just the way they had adjusted it. There was a fellow from... the racetrack or the testing ground in England that did his best to get the thing working, and then so I also by not calling it perfect, I probably got myself in some political trouble. But that's
the first of many, right? You in political trouble. I've never seen you shy away from that, Dan.
I think I ended up going fast, and they were happy.
Tends to quiet people a fair amount. You know what? Yeah. What I love, again, just looking at the progression of cars, is going from those glorious Ferraris to the beautiful E-Type, and then to the Porsche 718. I mean, you and Joe Bonnier was. I don't know. If I'm thinking of dream vehicles to drive, boy, it sounds like you were closing your eyes, making a wish, and they were just popping up in front of you. Tell me, if you can, a little bit about this interaction with the factory Porsche.
That's probably the first time I met Hushke von Hanstein.
Yeah.
Who was a great character in his own, and also Evie's boss at Porsche.
Hmm.
Yeah. Now let me think. They, in those days, believe it or not, Porsche was at the stage where they wanted to win one of the lesser categories, and they knew that they had not yet reached the point where they were going to compete with the big boys. So it was. They were. Fiercely doing their best to run and hopefully achieve reliability. None of us had heard of that before, especially on a 24-hour thing.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the result, I believe you had an engine problem, but it is unfathomable these days to think about Porsche being in a place in their timeline where A, they didn't want to take on the top class, and B, perfect reliability wasn't associated with their name in endurance racing.
That's right. Well, it wasn't that they didn't want to, it was just that they couldn't.
Hmm.
I mean, they're small. And
sure.
Air-cooled. So that was before they finally admitted that it might be better to use a liquid-cooled.
A different type of liquid, a wetter form of liquid, I guess you could say.
Yep.
So, you know, moving to 62, I had to look this up because Scuderia SSS Repubblica di Venezia, you and Bonnier in the Ferrari 250, I wasn't even aware that of that team's existence, or much less that it wasn't a direct factory program. I don't know if there are any funny or interesting stories with that, but going from factory-affiliated teams and so on seemed like that was a bit of an odd... entered under an odd name, at least.
That's right. That's the name. Volpe was a great guy and a big fan of automobile racing. He, I believe he's the one that did a really good... film of Juan Fangio, including several laps around the Modena Autodromo.
Yeah.
And, Giovanni Volpi was just part of the Italian nobility, and I think Enzo wanted to be friendly with him, and he ended up with that car. I don't know, he might have had more than one.
So you know what stands out, Dan, looking through at least the first half of your Le Mans record, and I'm not saying this because you did these things, but I look through and it's a head gasket or an engine or a gearbox. There's so many, you know, quality drives, quality efforts, but again, maybe for those today who are used to almost every single car finishing, back then it was a true test of endurance. It wasn't just a test of who could win, but can you make it to the finish? How much of that was in your mindset when you're driving, whether it was a Ferrari or a Porsche, you name it? I mean, breaking things seemed to be almost part of the norm.
Well, tell you, after 8 or 9 times, I realized that I could drive pretty fast, and it was faster than Briggs Cunningham could drive, but Cunningham used to finish ahead of me every single time.
Mm.
And I thought to myself, dink busted, that's trying to tell me something. And at that time, it was much more of an endurance race than a race. So Briggs could do a very good job of not beating up on the car. I adopted the Briggs Cunningham method of running at Le Mans.
Hmm. So in 63, you were back with Chinetti and had a certain Texan who also gained quite a bit of fame for being an engineer / driver / thinker. I just love the concept, you know, as an engineering geek myself, I just love the idea of Dan Gurney and Jim Hall together in the same car. Tell me about, and it wasn't as if you two had just met, but tell me about getting the chance to race with Jim there at Le Mans in Ferrari 330. That seems like it would have been either a lot of fun or the two of you would have not gotten along at all.
Well, it's funny, but I'm getting a bit of a blank there in memory-wise, but I know I had enormous respect for Jim Hall and Hap Sharp and Midland, Texas, where I had never been, but I was well aware that that was the birthplace of a lot of terrific cars that were world class. So in the end, you end up, you got to decide whether you're a driver who wants to try to beat your teammate by going fast, or collaborate and try and win the race. And you know, I was in the transitional stage at that time but really the thing that I got from Cunningham was the fact that I spoke to my good friend A.J. Foyt.
Mm.
For 67, and gave him that story, and he was receptive enough so that we both ended up driving the car carefully like that, and we ended up in the average speed for the whole race, and we had a trouble-free race, and Briggs would have been happy.
Aw. Well, you know, I was reading something today about that 67 race, and something that you had said about you were very careful in not wanting to turn it into a interpersonal speed competition between you and AJ. And not that you two would have just done that automatically, but you said something about going out and practice and qualifying and such, and intentionally running, you know, 6, 7, 8 seconds slower because, you know, you just wanted to get you didn't want AJ to feel like he had to measure up to anything, or that there was any kind of, you know, laying down some sort of lap time as you know, a signal of bravery. Was that just part of that kind of Briggs Cunningham mentality of...
I never ran the car within 4 seconds of what it would have done if you wanted to go for it.
Yeah.
But I spent a lot of time with AJ, who was at the peak of his international fame at the time, really. And I don't think he believed me at first. But
believed you in terms of?
Of me talking about how Cunningham ran.
Hmm.
Bravery doesn't enter into it, but skill in extracting the lap time does. And if you do go for it, and all of a sudden it's hard for the teammate to match it or equal it or whatever it would be, all of a sudden he's going to start breaking the rules that we were trying to live by to try and go faster.
Sure.
And that's just normal with any driver or teammate. But politically, you can't say that.
Of course.
Yeah.
So if I look at that 67 Le Mans race, I know you've spoken about this probably to the point where you fall asleep, but that was also a fairly magical time for you, whether it's qualifying in the middle of the front row for Indy, then Le Mans, obviously, world famous win in 67, then obviously going to Spa and having, doing what you did there, that's, I think, maybe even more famous for some of us in America, at least. I don't know. If I'm talking about a pretty good stretch of days in Dan Gurney's life, man, those seem to be golden.
Well, yeah, you're right. That's a storybook outcome. When you drive for Ford Motor Company, and there are competing factions, some of the cars are entered by Carroll Shelby, or Shelby American. The others are from Holman and Moody.
Yeah.
And there are lots of different combination of IndyCar drivers and other drivers, some of which don't have a whole lot of road race experience. Not to mention the endurance racing. So that was that's a politically volatile situation to be in.
Yeah, I bet.
It is. It was. But, for instance, I think AJ and I were expected to be the rabbits in this fight, and I got the car dialed in a little bit before AJ came, and I wanted to get it where it had the right balance to it aerodynamically, and once I did, he was happy with it. And but when we went to qualify, I think we qualified 7th or 8th, something like that.
Yeah.
And they came and said, "Well, what's going on? What's wrong with the car? That kind of stuff." And I said, "Hey, the car's great. Don't worry about it at all." And they just didn't want to hear that.
Mm.
But to them, it was a 24-hour race. And to us, it was finally emulating Cunningham, who was there. And this was my 10th attempt. So I wasn't going to let that cloud division.
Yeah, I mean, you were on pole the year before, and I guess the nice way of putting it to them is you'd figured out nine times, you'd successfully figured out on nine occasions how not to win, and you were determined on your 10th to correct.
I mean, you wouldn't expect something to go haywire if you were not abusing the car.
Sure.
But in that case, it was a head gasket. Well, in 66, too bad. shared that car with Jerry Grant, right?
Yeah.
And Jerry was a really outstanding road racer, as well as an IndyCar racer.
Absolutely.
He was a natural. And we got along famously. You try to say, well, wait a minute. 10 years, the 10th attempt, you ought to apply something.
Dan, I'm 45 years old, still trying to figure out some of the basics, so trust me.
Well, there you are, yeah.
Looking at all the things you achieved as a driver in particular, where does that 1967 Le Mans win stand? I'm not talking about, you know, asking you to rate greatest or any of that stuff, but just in terms of when you think of all you achieved, where does that stand just in, from a personal enjoyment or appreciation standpoint? I mean, I know we love it, but does it stand as one of your favorites?
A win of a world-famous event where you're up against some pretty doggone good competition. Ferrari, for instance. And what's the guy's name? Michaels. He was the Ferrari race engineer.
Hmm.
I've
forgotten. My apologies.
Well, I forgot too. But anyway, while it wasn't a pure driving, or if you're trying to be the quickest guy in the world, it wasn't that kind of a win. But it was, in many ways, it was even better because. We did, AJ and I both set new records in the highest average speed, and we won some of the ones that the little French cars used to win all the time, the index of performance or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was with a 427, and normally that wouldn't have happened.
Hmm.
All of that, and if you do very well, I guess Hank the Deuce or Henry Ford the Second liked the fact that that particular car was made in the States and with two American drivers driving for it.
Absolutely.
And that meant something extra to him. So all of that, each little piece... adds up to a pretty good pile of wonderfulness. So I would put that, it still is, an achievement that meant a great deal to us. I know it did to AJ, and it did to me.
Absolutely.
The other one is more of a spa, is more of a Lone Ranger kind of personal thing. It's not quite so much of a team. Although there was a lot of teamwork.
No Tontos involved in that one, or in the same way, at least.
Yeah, it was just different. It was a place that had reputation of being scary fast, and so it was treated with a great deal of respect.
Hmm.
Spa was.
So we have our friends at Ford and many of the Ford family members that are heading over to Le Mans here in about a week or so, as they head back with, as a factory, they head back with the modern version of the GT. Does that bring any pride or satisfaction to you to see that, even though we're talking the better part of 50 years later, Ford still has a fight in them and still wants to go beat up on Ferrari and Porsche and some of the others who've been keeping the flame alight?
When I first saw some artist concept of the car, I thought, wow, that's zoomy looking. I wonder if it's any good. And then I recently read a pretty good article about it, and they've been to all the right places and had the right people going, so it could be a terrific performer, and I'm I'm glad to see that. I was worried that they might have gone there with the PR department running things.
Mm.
But I don't think that's the case. They got some wise old birds, old geezers, who they know what it's going to take. So I feel a lot of confidence that everybody's going to be proud of.
Well, I guess the last question I have for you is: has anyone from Ford sent one of the GTs by the AAR shops yet? And if not, let me know, and I'll start yelling at them. I mean, they need to pay their respects here. Come on now.
They did invite us. Evie and I were invited over there, but I'm not going to make it because of my heart condition and so forth. But I am going to be at the one at Pebble Beach where they're going to have, I don't know if that's, yeah, that's afterwards. So
yeah,
the cars will be there, and that'll be very nice to see. It's very difficult to tell in this day and age politically how much of a grand effort they plan to put forth.
Well, I know with the caliber of drivers that they have, hiring Chip Ganassi, who takes nothing for granted. The European team that they have, I mean, they're not only are they spending a lot of money, but they've got a lot of very serious players involved. So they, you know, Ford could have made a bunch of mistakes and hired the wrong people to try and bring glory back to Michigan.
Yeah.
But well, not as if Corvette Racing hasn't brought plenty of glory back, but at least to Dearborn, I can tell you, at least in my opinion, they've hired the right people to do it. Are they going to do it their first year back? I think that might be a little optimistic, but I wouldn't be surprised if at least one of the drivers from one of the cars was up there spraying champagne.
I agree. I think they're reaching with that in mind, and so they're being pretty thorough, and there's a lot of wisdom that was gained over a long period of time among the people in charge. So that should be very good. You know, it was only recently, maybe a month ago, they sent me some little stickers or something, or maybe little cards, that one for each of the drivers.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to put something on it. And I just said, something like, good luck, and remember, it's an endurance contest.
I love it.
Now, what is later on, when, after I was no longer driving, I was very impressed with the 24-hour at Daytona, I think, and the Porsche with Pedro, I think, was driving one, and Joe Siffert.
Yep.
Another one, and they were qualifying every lap, practically, and they finished. So that was something that evolved later.
Well, we have the. We have what you and so many that were part of that program and that win, and I mean, that it wasn't the only win, but that win in 67 that, I don't know, I think we're going to celebrate that one for a long time, Dan, whether it's 50 years ago,
yeah,
60, you name it.
Definitely was a good one. Whether anyone else celebrates it or not, we can.
Exactly. Yeah. We're not waiting for the party. We're going to hold one ourselves.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, thank you as always, sir. I really, as you know, I cherish the time whenever we can spend time, whether it's in person or on the phone. And you keep putting that stuff in the rearview mirror.
All right. Great, Marshall. Good talking with you.
Thank
you. Good luck over there.
Well, give your lovely wife my love, and I look forward to seeing you hopefully around Pebble Beach.
All right. Great, Marshall.
Thank you.
Have a good 24-hour.
Thank you, sir.
It's hard not to love that infectious laugh of Dan's. At 85 years old, still sharp as can be. Just an American treasure. A genuine American treasure. Thanks for listening. Check out more podcasts and other content. MarshallPruitt.com.